Hello, and welcome to the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Audio Abstracts. I'm Dr. Erin Bennett, and on behalf of PCCM, I'm happy to present this audio recording of the research abstracts that appear in this month's issue. Let's get started. Abstract 1 is a featured original research article by Lopez Fernandez et al. The Prevalence and Outcome of Acute Hypoxemic Respiratory Failure, or PANDORA, Study in Mechanically Ventilated Children, Prospective Multicenter Epidemiology in Spain from 2019 to 2021. Objectives: to describe the epidemiology and outcome of children with acute hypoxemic respiratory failure and or pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome, or pediatric ARDS. Design: prospective observational study in six non-consecutive two-month blocks from October 2019 to September 2021. Setting: a network of 22 PICUs in Spain. Patients: consecutive children 7 days to 15 years old with a diagnosis of acute hypoxemic respiratory failure defined by a PaO2-FiO2 ratio less than or equal to 300 millimeters of mercury who needed invasive mechanical ventilation, or IMV, using positive end expiratory pressure, or PEEP, greater than or equal to 5 centimeters of water and FiO2 greater than or equal to 0.3. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. The primary outcomes were acute hypoxemic respiratory failure prevalence and PICU mortality. The secondary outcomes were the prevalence of IMV with pediatric ARDS and the use of adjunctive therapies. There were 6,545 PICU admissions. 1,374, or 21%, underwent invasive mechanical ventilation, and 181, or 2.8%, had acute hypoxemic respiratory failure. 91 patients, including 1.4% of PICU admissions, 6.6% of invasive mechanical ventilation cases, and 50.3% of acute hypoxemic respiratory failure cases, met the second Pediatric Acute Lung Injury Consensus Conference Invasive Mechanical Ventilation Pediatric ARDS criteria. At baseline, mean tidal volume was 7.4 plus or minus a standard deviation of 1.8 milliliters per kilogram of ideal body weight. PEEP was 8.4 plus or minus a standard deviation of 3.1 centimeters of water. FiO2 was 0.68 plus or minus a standard deviation of 0.23. And plateau pressure was 25.7 plus or minus a standard deviation of 6.3 centimeters of water. Unlike patients with pediatric ARDS, adjunctive therapies were used infrequently in non-pediatric ARDS acute hypoxemic respiratory failure patients. Acute hypoxemic respiratory failure patients without pediatric ARDS had more ventilator-free days than pediatric ARDS patients, 16.4 plus or minus 9.4 versus 11.2 plus or minus 10.5, with a p-value equal to 0.002. All-cause PICU mortality in acute hypoxemic respiratory failure cases was higher in pediatric ARDS versus non-pediatric ARDS patients, 30.8% with a 95% confidence interval of 21.5 to 41.3 versus 14.4% with a 95% confidence interval of 7.9 to 23.4 and a p-value equal to 0.01. Conclusions. In our 2019 to 2021 PICU population, the prevalence of acute hypoxemic respiratory failure is 2.8% of invasive mechanical ventilation cases. Of such patients, the prevalence of pediatric ARDS was 50.3%, and there was a 30.8% mortality, which was higher than in cases of acute hypoxemic respiratory failure without pediatric ARDS. Abstract 2 is a featured original research article by Chapman et al. Organ Procurement Organization Donation Requesters Describe Barriers to Pediatric Organ Donation. Objectives: Organ Procurement Organization, or OPO, donation requester staff approach grieving families to discuss donating organs from their loved ones. We have carried out a qualitative study to explore the barriers that OPO donation requester staff face in accessing pediatric families and requesting consent. Design and participants: qualitative methods using structured interviews with an N equal to 31 and focus groups with an N equal to 33 with donation requester OPO personnel. Setting: phone interviews were conducted from November 2022 to January 2023, and focus groups were held at an August 2023 conference for donation and transplant professionals. Subjects included 64 donation requester OPO personnel. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Content analysis was used to code transcribed responses. Participants described a lack of access to pediatric families and portrayed clinical care teams as sometimes protective of the family or even preventing OPO staff from talking with the family. Participants shared potential solutions to overcome barriers, including fostering teamwork between clinical care teams and OPO staff and developing bridging language for clinicians to use when introducing donation requesters. Conclusions. Donation requesters face unique challenges when approaching grieving pediatric families, and more multidisciplinary work is needed to improve communication. Abstract 3 is a featured original research article by Duster et al. Early Sodium Bicarbonate Use in Pediatric In-Hospital Cardiac Arrest, a single-center retrospective cohort study from 2013 to 2023. Objectives: to explore the association of intra-arrest sodium bicarbonate use with outcomes in pediatric in-hospital cardiac arrest when accounting for the timing of initial sodium bicarbonate administration. We hypothesized that administration of sodium bicarbonate within the first 5 minutes of pediatric in-hospital cardiac arrest would be associated with greater odds of hospital survival and return of spontaneous circulation. Design: retrospective cohort study. Setting: Quaternary Care Children's Hospital. Patients: children 18 years old or younger with pulseless in-hospital cardiac arrest of at least 5 minutes duration at our institution between January 2013 and January 2023 with complete data were included. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Of 243 index events of pediatric in-hospital cardiac arrest, 99 or 41% received sodium bicarbonate in the first 5 minutes of cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR. Overall, 107 patients or 44% survived a hospital discharge and return of spontaneous circulation was achieved in 91 of 243 patients or 37%. A logistic treatment effects estimation utilizing inverse probability weighting via a propensity score was performed to compare the effects of sodium bicarbonate use within the first 5 minutes of CPR with those who did not receive early sodium bicarbonate. In this analysis, we failed to detect an association between early sodium bicarbonate compared with not and differing adjusted odds of survival to discharge and return of spontaneous circulation. The adjusted odds ratio for survival to discharge was 0.87 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.45 to 1.69 and a p-value equal to 0.687. And the adjusted odds ratio for return of spontaneous circulation was 0.82 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.43 to 1.56 and a p-value equal to 0.537. Conclusions. In this retrospective cohort study of pediatric in-hospital cardiac arrest, we failed to detect an association between timing of sodium bicarbonate and odds of survival to hospital discharge and return of spontaneous circulation. These findings warrant reevaluation of the evidence and support a less restrictive recommendation for sodium bicarbonate use during pediatric in-hospital cardiac arrest in U.S. national guidelines. Abstract 4 is a clinical investigation article by Zhu et al. Prevalence and Associated Explanatory Factors for Augmented Renal Clearance in Early Sepsis, Single-Center Retrospective PICU Cohort in China from 2022 to 2023. Objectives. We aimed to 1. Evaluate the prevalence of augmented renal clearance in pediatric sepsis patients. 2. Analyze potential explanatory factors associated with augmented renal clearance out of hemodynamic, oxygenation, and inflammatory parameters. And 3. Assess augmented renal clearance outcomes. Design: retrospective single-center cohort from January 2022 to June 2023. Setting: PICU at a tertiary care hospital in China. Patients: children 28 days to 16 years of age admitted with sepsis defined using Phoenix sepsis criteria. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Among 69 patients, 34 or 49.3% were categorized as having augmented renal clearance. Designation as having augmented renal clearance versus not was associated with being younger, median 2.4 versus 7.2 years and a p-value less than 0.001, hemodynamic and intrarenal flow changes, and higher C-reactive protein levels, 31 versus 12 milligrams per liter with a p-value less than 0.05. None of the 34 patients with augmented renal clearance developed acute kidney injury, but 22 of 35 non-augmented renal clearance patients did. Augmented renal clearance was associated with shorter PICU stays, median 7 versus 11 days, and a p-value less than 0.05. Univariate regression analyses identified fluid balance, cardiac function parameters, renal resistive index, and inflammatory markers as explanatory factors associated with augmented renal clearance. Conclusions. In this retrospective cohort of pediatric sepsis patients admitted to the PICU, the prevalence of early onset augmented renal clearance is around 50%, and younger patients may be at risk. The presence of augmented renal clearance is associated with hemodynamic and inflammatory responses. Taken together, more prospective work is needed with an emphasis on drug-level targeting and a better understanding of interactions with intrarenal pathophysiology. Abstract 5 is a clinical investigation article by Thon Vo et al. In-hospital mortality in mechanically ventilated children with severe dengue fever, explanatory factors in a single-center retrospective cohort from Vietnam, 2013 to 2022. Objectives: severe dengue fever complicated by critical respiratory failure requiring mechanical ventilation contributes to high mortality rates among PICU-admitted patients. This study aimed to identify key explanatory variables of fatality in mechanically ventilated children with severe dengue. Design: retrospective cohort from 2013 to 2022. Setting: PICU of the Tertiary Children's Hospital No. 2 in Vietnam. Patients included 200 children with severe dengue fever who received mechanical ventilation. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We analyzed clinical and laboratory data during the PICU stay. The primary outcome was 28-day in-hospital mortality. Backward stepwise multivariable logistic regression was performed to identify the explanatory variables associated with dengue-associated mortality at the initiation of mechanical ventilation. The model performance was assessed using C-statistics, calibration plot, and Breyer score. The patients had a median age of 7 years with an interquartile range of 4 to 9. Overall, 47 or 24% of 200 patients died in the hospital. Five factors were associated with greater odds of mortality. 1. Severe transaminitis, including aspartate aminotransferase or alanine aminotransferase greater than or equal to 1,000 international units per liter. 2. High blood lactate levels. 3. Vasoactive inotropic score greater than 30. 4. Dengue encephalitis. And 5. Peak inspiratory pressure on mechanical ventilation. The model performance in training and test sets was a C statistic of 0.86 in training and 0.84 in test, a good calibration slope of 1 in training and 0.89 in tests, and a Breyer score of 0.08. Conclusions. In our center from 2013 to 2022, mechanically ventilated patients with severe dengue had a high mortality rate. The main explanatory factors associated with greater odds of death related to critical liver injury, shock, and mechanical ventilation may inform future practices in such critically ill patients. Abstract 6 is a clinical investigation article by Nice et al. Enteral nutrition during non-invasive ventilation in the PICU, single-center retrospective study from 2019 to 2023. Objectives: to evaluate our practice and complications of enteral nutrition in pediatric patients supported with non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, or NIPPV, excluding high-flow nasal cannula. Design: retrospective study. Setting: single PICU in a tertiary children's hospital. Patients: we included children from birth to 18 years old who were admitted between January 2019 and June 2023 who received at least 24 hours of NIPPV. We excluded patients on home NIPPV, those dependent on parenteral nutrition, and those undergoing abdominal pathology, which precluded use of enteral nutrition. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We characterized and evaluated our PICU patients on NIPPV and analyzed the associated odds of initiating enteral nutrition. Characteristics analyzed included age, duration and type of NIPPV, route of enteral nutrition delivery, time to initiate and reach goal enteral nutrition, use of sedation, and preceding intubation during admission. Complications reviewed included emesis, aspiration, radiograph exposure for feeding tube placement, intubation, and death. Overall, there were 512 separate episodes of NIPPV, of which 204 required enteral nutrition, with about two-thirds via a post-pyloric feeding tube. Initiation of enteral nutrition occurred by a median of 24 hours of NIPPV, and goal calories were reached by a median of 39 hours. After multivariable analysis, episodes of NIPPV associated with greater odds of enteral nutrition had medical complexity and longer NIPPV duration. Age 1 year young or younger was associated with greater odds of using enteral nutrition. Emesis occurred in 36 NIPPV episodes, and there were only 3 aspiration events. In all episodes of NIPPV, use of enteral nutrition was associated with longer PICU and hospital lengths of stay. Conclusions. Enteral nutrition is often limited in children receiving NIPPV. In our single-center review, few complications were noted when providing enteral nutrition to children during NIPPV. As use continues to increase, further research is warranted to clarify the role of enteral nutrition and its relationship to length of stay while on NIPPV. Abstract 7 is a PCCM trial by Weiss et al. Time course of kidney injury biomarkers in children with septic shock. Nested cohort study within the pragmatic pediatric trial of balanced versus normal saline fluid in sepsis trial. Objective: severe acute kidney injury, or AKI, portends poor outcomes in pediatric sepsis. We evaluated the trajectory and prognostic utility of AKI biomarkers in pediatric septic shock using a subset of participants in the ongoing pragmatic pediatric trial of balanced versus normal saline fluid in sepsis, or PROMPT bolus trial. We tested whether fluid volume is associated with persistent elevation of urine neutrophil gelatinase-associated lipocalin. Design: prospective non-pre-specified cohort study within the PROMPT bolus trial. Setting: 3 children's hospitals in the United States. Patients: 478 patients aged 2 months to younger than 18 years old with septic shock. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results: urine neutrophil gelatinase associated lipocalin, kidney injury molecule 1, liver fatty acid binding protein, and interleukin 18 and plasma cystatin C were collected at presentation, or T1, days 2 to 3, T2, and before discharge and or death, T3. At presentation, 418 or 88% had no or only stage 1 AKI, and 60 or 12% had stage 2 or 3 AKI defined using kidney disease improving global outcomes creatinine thresholds. All biomarkers were higher with stage 2 and 3 compared with no or stage 1 AKI at T1 and T2, but only cystatin C remained higher at T3. Among patients with no or stage 1 AKI at presentation, those with urine neutrophil gelatinase-associated lipocalin greater than or equal to 150 versus less than 150 nanograms per milliliter had fewer hospital-free days, 21 days with an interquartile range of 15 to 24 days versus 23 days with an interquartile range of 19 to 25 days and a p-value equal to 0.05. After applying inverse probability treatment weighting to balance covariates, 14% of patients who received greater than 100 milliliters per kilogram within 48 hours had persistently elevated urine neutrophil gelatinase-associated lipocalin over time, compared with 6% who received 40 to 100 milliliters per kilogram, with an odds ratio of 2.7 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.1 to 6.2. Hospital-free days were no different across fluid volume groups. Conclusions: although kidney injury biomarkers mirrored serum creatinine in children with septic shock, elevated urine neutrophil gelatinase-associated lipocalin identified a subset with subclinical AKI with fewer hospital-free days despite no or stage 1 AKI by creatinine. Children receiving greater than 100 milliliters per kilogram of fluid had greater odds of early and persistently elevated urine neutrophil gelatinase-associated lipocalin, suggesting high fluid volumes may perpetuate initial kidney damage. Abstract 8 is a PCCM conference report and expert panel by Andrus et al. Themes in the management of pediatric brain death contestation: exploratory qualitative work from multidisciplinary health professionals in the United States. Objectives: to explore health professionals' experiences of contested pediatric brain death or death by neurologic criteria cases, including factors contributing to conflict, resource needs and utilization, perceived utility of supports available, and case resolution and aftermath. Design and methods: inductive thematic analysis of semi-structured interviews with members of the Society of Critical Care Medicine, or SCCM, Contestation of Pediatric Brain Death Task Force. Setting: 10 institutions across 7 U.S. states and the District of Columbia. Participants: 19 task force members were interviewed in 2023, including pediatric intensivists, neurologists, nurses, respiratory therapists, attorneys, palliative care clinicians, social workers, ethicists, and hospital leadership. Task force members were recruited primarily because of their experience with contested brain death or death by neurologic criteria, although some were recruited because of expertise in other relevant topics, such as communication, information acquisition in brain death and death by neurologic criteria, and health equity. There were no interventions, measurements, and main results. We identified 5 themes relevant to managing pediatric brain death or death by neurologic criteria contestation. 1. Personnel to consider involving, including subspecialty consultation, social work, hospital leadership and administration, ethics teams, legal counsel, and security. 2, timelines to maintain, including factors to consider when deciding the most appropriate family accommodations. 3, support for families and patients, including strategies to enhance communication, identifying and mitigating mistrust, and connecting families with support both within and outside the hospital. 4, support for staff, including disseminating information throughout the care team, staff support for one another, and establishing written documentation and policies. And 5, complementary strategies that may augment approaches to brain death or death by neurologic criteria contestation, such as policies addressing requests for potentially inappropriate treatment. Conclusions. Family contestation of pediatric brain death or death by neurologic criteria challenges all parties involved. The 5 themes identified from our qualitative analysis of interviews with experienced professionals do not constitute SCCM clinical practice guidance, but they will be used to inform the development of approaches to brain death or death by neurologic criteria contestation through further scholarship and community consultation. Abstract 9 is under PCCM Notes, Methods, and Statistics by Martin et al. Use of the area under the precision recall curve to evaluate prediction models of rare critical illness events. In the critical care setting, where missed diagnoses and false alarms can have significant consequences, evaluating the performance of a classification or binary prediction model must be nuanced, critical, and thorough. Traditionally, the area under the receiver operating characteristic curve has been used as the primary evaluation metric for most models. The receiver operating characteristic curve is a plot of a model's sensitivity, also known as recall or true positive rate, and specificity, true negative rate, at each possible model output threshold, typically a score or probability. The area under the receiver operating characteristic curve thus provides a global evaluation of a model's ability to discriminate between the two outcome classes by summarizing the sensitivity-specificity trade-off over all model output thresholds. However, the area under the receiver operating characteristic curve may be misinterpreted clinically when the outcome of interest is rare. Such scenarios are referred to as imbalanced because of the large ratio of negative to positive, or vice versa, cases. In these situations, a model may have a high area under the receiver operating characteristic curve as a result of the robust true negative rate or specificity, yet be unable to reliably identify positive cases. Accordingly, the area under the receiver operating characteristic curve may not give clinicians the insights they seek when deciding whether a classification model will clinically be useful. Many events of interest in the critical care setting, including mortality, clinical deterioration, and acute kidney injury, are imbalanced in our datasets because only a minority of our patients suffer these events, less than 10 to 20%. In such situations, the precision recall curve and area under the precision recall curve offer more clinically relevant and operationally useful measures of performance. The sensitivity or recall of a model indicates the proportion of all positive cases the model can identify. The positive predictive value, or PPV, or precision, is the proportion of positive predictions that are correct. Both are intuitive concepts for clinicians. By measuring the trade-off between sensitivity and positive predictive value, the area under the precision recall curve aligns better with what we care about in imbalanced problems, reliable identification of a rare event. Further, precision recall curves can illustrate the operational implications of model deployment in critical care settings. Here, we demonstrate the utility of the area under the precision recall curve and precision recall curves when predicting rare critical illness events using simulated pediatric data. Abstract 10 is a research letter by Baker and Spader, External Validation of the Phoenix Sepsis Score in a Single Pediatric Cardiac ICU. To the editor, in 2024, the Phoenix Sepsis Criteria and accompanying Phoenix Sepsis Score, or PSS, were published reframing sepsis as a life-threatening infection in the setting of organ dysfunction. External validation of the Phoenix Sepsis Score in diverse populations and settings is a necessary next step. Patients with cardiac disease requiring admission to the pediatric cardiac ICU or CICU may be at increased risk for developing sepsis. We sought to evaluate the validity of the Phoenix sepsis score in a cohort of patients in the pediatric cardiac ICU at our institution. Our retrospective cohort study, titled Association of Co-Met Display on Clinical Outcomes, was approved by the University of Virginia School of Medicine Institutional Review Board on February 20, 2024, with waiver of consent to analyze routinely collected data. Procedures were followed in accordance with the ethical standards of human experimentation of our IRB and the Helsinki Declaration of 1975. We included patients younger than 18 years admitted to the CICU at our institution from July 2020 to June 2024, meeting criteria for sepsis by Phoenix Sepsis Score. We defined infection as the collection of a blood culture specimen with the initiation or broadening of parenteral antibiotics and assessed for the presence of sepsis and septic shock by Phoenix Sepsis Score in the 6 hours before and following blood culture collection. Repeat events and events occurring during extracorporeal life support were excluded. 172 patients who met sepsis criteria by Phoenix Sepsis Score were included in our study. Nearly all, or 96%, also met septic shock criteria. Demographic and clinical characteristics are presented. At the time of sepsis diagnosis, 88% of patients were receiving a continuous infusion of milrinone. 20% of sepsis cases and 32% of septic shock cases would not otherwise have met the criteria if not for the contribution of milrinone to the Phoenix Sepsis Score, 1 point for cardiovascular dysfunction. In-hospital mortality was 13% and not associated with age, single ventricle physiology, or Phoenix Sepsis Score septic shock. Total Phoenix Sepsis Score points were not associated with in-hospital mortality, p equal to 0.086, even after adjusting for age, p equal to 0.065. A secondary analysis excluding the 20% of cases that met criteria based on milrinone alone yielded similar results. We observed three important challenges when applying the Phoenix Sepsis Score to our cohort. The variability of milrinone use in the CICU is not well reported, and our institutional practice may have led to an overdiagnosis of sepsis and septic shock by Phoenix Sepsis Score. The quantification of the degree of respiratory dysfunction in patients with single ventricle physiology, or 33% of our cohort, can be difficult. To mitigate this issue, we preferentially used the ratio of oxygen saturation by pulse oximetry to FiO2 when assessing respiratory dysfunction in patients with single ventricle physiology. Finally, several patients were receiving continuous sedation at the time of diagnosis, potentially confounding the assessment of neurologic dysfunction. Our observed in-hospital mortality was similar, although slightly higher than the rate of 10.8% reported for septic shock in higher resource settings in the Phoenix Sepsis Score study. Our cohort had associated cardiac comorbidities, which likely conferred an increased risk of mortality in the setting of septic shock. Assessment of sepsis in the CICU can be challenging. Signs and symptoms that may be suspicious for sepsis, like fever or tachycardia, can be secondary to non-infectious causes, like heart failure or sedative withdrawal, and differences in care practices and patient physiology likely need to be considered when assessing for Phoenix Sepsis Score organ dysfunction in this population. Given the limited single-center nature of our investigation, a multi-center external validation with the potential tailoring of the Phoenix Sepsis Score for the CICU population is needed. Abstract 11 is a research letter by Gathers et al. Diversity Engagement of Pediatric Critical Care Fellows, a U.S. survey of 81 fellows at 15 fellowship programs in 2022. Creating diverse and inclusive learning environments is essential to delivering equitable healthcare. One issue is the representation of racially or ethnically underrepresented in medicine fellows in our pediatric critical care programs. For example, even as the number of pediatric critical care fellows in the United States increased from 304 to 504 from 2007 to 2019, the proportion of underrepresented in medicine fellows decreased from 13.2% in 2007 to 11.5% in 2019, with a p-value equal to 0.006. A second issue is that we do not know the degree to which pediatric critical care fellowship programs foster diversity and inclusion. Therefore, we evaluated the American Association of Medical Colleges, or AAMC, Diversity Engagement Survey scores using U.S. pediatric critical care fellows and assessed survey responses from 2022. Our aim was to identify evidence of 1. Underrepresented in medicine identity, and 2. Exposure to a diversity, equity, and inclusion curriculum. Our hypothesis is that we would find lower scores among the underrepresented in medicine fellows and those without exposure to a diversity, equity, inclusion curriculum in their fellowship program. The analysis of AAMC survey data was exempted from human research review by the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia Institutional Review Board. Individual consent was implied by AAMC survey completion. Between June 6, 2022 and July 6, 2022, we surveyed pediatric critical care fellows whose programs participate in the Education and Pediatric Intensive Care Investigator Network. The 8 factors of the Diversity Engagement Survey connect engagement theory to inclusion and diversity constructs, with diversity engagement scores assessed on a 5-point scale. 1 equals strongly disagree, 5 equals strongly agree. Our survey consisted of 56 questions across 4 domains: diversity, equity, inclusion, curriculum exposure, diversity engagement survey scores, program demographics, and participant demographics. Pediatric Critical Care Fellowship program directors were sent surveys to distribute to their fellows. Only program directors who confirmed distribution to fellows were included in the survey response rate. The T-test compared diversity engagement survey scores based on underrepresented in medicine identity and diversity equity inclusion curriculum exposure, with p-value of less than 0.05 being statistically significant. Overall, out of 38 program directors contacted, 15 confirmed receipt of the survey. These 15 programs included 147 fellows and 81, or 52%, provided responses. Of the respondents, 16 of 81, or 20%, identified as underrepresented in medicine, and 39 of 81, or 48%, reported that their pediatric critical care program had a diversity, equity, inclusion curriculum. The mean diversity engagement survey score in respondents was 4.14, with a 95% confidence interval of 4 to 4.28. On comparing scores in underrepresented in medicine versus non-underrepresented in medicine fellows, we failed to identify a difference in mean diversity engagement survey scores, 4.29 versus 4.11, with a p-value equal to 0.3. Mean diversity engagement survey scores were lower among respondents training in a program without a diversity, equity, inclusion curriculum versus respondents training in a program with a curriculum, 3.96 versus 4.33, and a p-value less than 0.01. Respondents indicated that the most common barriers to implementing a diversity, equity, inclusion curriculum were time, funding, and lack of trained faculty. In this pilot study of 81 pediatric critical care fellows from 15 programs in 2022, we found that fellows who declared exposure to a diversity, equity, inclusion curriculum within their program versus not had higher diversity engagement survey scores. The perceived barriers to implementing a diversity, equity, inclusion curriculum included time, funding, and the availability of trained faculty. Taking all of the above together, these preliminary findings indicate that further research is needed to enhance diversity engagement and to implement a diversity, equity, inclusion curriculum. It is possible that multi-center collaboration could help mitigate the barriers to implementation. We also wonder whether other components of a broader curriculum, like spiritual care in the PICU, recently also identified by fellows as a gap in knowledge, could be added to such a program. In conclusion, pediatric critical care training fellows may lack knowledge and understanding in another area of professional ethics, and without a curriculum that fosters diversity, equity, inclusion, engagement, future high-quality, equitable healthcare may be compromised. The PCCM narrative this month is by Schruten and Markovitz. Just because I can't talk doesn't mean I have nothing to say. I was sitting in the chair next to my 3-month-old son Jack's hospital crib when the intensivist came over to talk with me. Before I had a chance to stand up, he knelt down beside my chair so he was eye level with me rather than looking down on me when he spoke. This simple gesture was impactful and a rare interaction during Jack's lengthy PICU admission. It made me feel like an equal participant in the discussion rather than merely a listener. As Jack's intensivist, of course I don't recall this interaction at all. What is striking is how such a simple gesture was so important to this mother. The inherent hierarchy between physician and parent is exacerbated by a physical one, physician towering over the parent. One has to literally level the playing field to engage in a meaningful, shared dialogue. The art of communication in the doctor-patient relationship would become even more significant because Jack was born with a rare muscular dystrophy that caused him to be nonverbal. As Jack's mom, I learned to interpret his gaze, gestures, and nuances, all of which were his voice. However, I experienced many encounters with doctors and other healthcare professionals who dismissed Jack's ability to communicate. It takes exceptional patience and powers of observation to connect with a nonverbal child, but most importantly, it takes a desire to want to communicate with them. As these words printed on one of Jack's t-shirts tell us, "Just because I can't talk doesn't mean I have nothing to say." After learning so much about caring for a medically complex child, Anne knew there were stories from parents and physicians that needed to be told. we joined forces and reached out to our networks for stories. In 2021, Shared Struggles, Stories from Parents and Pediatricians Caring for Children with Serious Illnesses was published. As we collected and offered commentaries on each story, I was moved at times, but never to tears. Maybe I had been doing this too long to have my armor pierced. Then we started giving grand rounds about the lessons from these stories. To my surprise, when reading the story by a physician who suddenly sees true humanity in a severely disabled child when visiting her at home, I get choked up. No matter how many times I read the story aloud, I become emotional. Why? Because all too often I am that doctor who cannot see or hear what these children are saying. Too often, I do not take the time to really pay attention and try to recognize that these children are communicating, albeit in a language I do not understand. Too often, I am the paternalistic physician who sometimes does not even listen or appreciate what the parents are seeing in their child. An excerpt from the book Shared Struggles reads, "I moved around to where I could see her face. I gave her a cheery hello, of course feeling it was more for the benefit of her mom than out of any expectation that she would register my presence. Then, in a moment that seemed almost staged, she shifted her eyes, looked right at me, and smiled. For all the times I had seen Cassie in the hospital, this was the first time I had seen a flicker of the person that her mother saw. For the first time, it dawned on me that Cassie really did communicate with her mother, and that although she may have not communicated in a way that the rest of the medical team would normally be alert to, it was nonetheless real and purposeful. I had made assumptions about Cassie and her mom. I do not believe that I had ever treated her as less than a person, but I do believe that I had not left space for her voice, regardless of what voice actually meant." The remainder of this story is in the book Shared Struggles. In addition to communication challenges, when your child has a disease that significantly impacts his body and abilities, quality of life is often questioned by the healthcare team. Quality of life is a sensitive subject for parents like us. It stings when we hear that doctors think our child has a low quality of life. Yet, I can understand this feeling. When Jack was discharged from the PICU with a tracheostomy and connected to a ventilator, I struggled with whether a child who would never walk, talk, or breathe without the assistance of a machine could have a good quality of life. But during the 15 years of his life, Jack taught me what a good life really means. Quality of life goes beyond our child's diagnosis and abilities. It is the relationship we have with our child that gives our child's life value, not what our child can and cannot do. I have learned to never pass judgment about the quality of life of a child. I try to always ask parents to share with me what their child is like at home on a good day. Show me a picture or video. Help me see your child through your eyes. I bristle when I hear others presume to be able to judge quality of life for a patient because, when we judge, we wrongly impose our values on the family. Another excerpt from Shared Struggles reads, "As Monica's mother tightly hugged her child in the final moments, weeping and crying out, I saw more clearly that the presence or absence of meaningful interactions was not something the physician can truly determine based on a diagnosis or prognosis. Meaning is found in that sacred relationship between the parent and the child. Quality of life has nothing to do with the value of life. There is a measurable value to every human life. Physicians never have all the answers. My crystal ball went dark long ago. Being humble about what we can and cannot do, see, or predict is the highest badge of courage. It is on us to teach this humility and these lessons to the next generation of physicians and providers." This concludes the abstracts for the June 2025 issue of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine. Thank you very much for listening. For more journal-related content, including access to the articles mentioned in this recording, please visit pccmjournal.org. Members of the SCCM Pediatric Section receive complimentary access to the PCCM Journal.